This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I hope that everyone is staying well and keeping vigilance during these trying times that we're in right now. And I know it's difficult staying at home, particularly those of you who perhaps have children who are home from school and you're having to figure out some way of handling them and perhaps even homeschooling them then as well. Well, you know, I know they're always looking for different kinds of activities and things to do during a day, and hopefully that one of the things that you are doing is going back and listening to some of the episodes from the Magic Word Podcast that are back in the archives, give you something kind of to do as you are going about your daily activities around the house. You could put on your headphones and go back and listen to some of these great episodes. I certainly thank all of you guys very much for tuning in and listening each week. We have such a diverse number of people and with diverse backgrounds and performers and those who are just interested in magic that have been on over the years. And I think that you'd find a lot of interesting things in the archives. And oftentimes people go back after they have seen a suggestion that I give them in the pod letter. So if you don't subscribe to the weekly pod letter, be sure to do that when you go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There should be a little screen that pops up that says to join the pod letter. And also that if it doesn't, there would be a place there where it says subscribe to the Magic Word, and there will be information there on how that you can do that. This week's episode is brought to you again by our sponsor, themagicbookshop.com. And I want to thank Eric Citron for all that he is doing. First of all, I want to mention that, of course, he is offering $100 in magic books of his choice that he will send to some lucky listener. We started the contest last week, and we're going to continue it here again this week, and going to wrap this up probably the next week. Probably next week. So if you have not yet registered for an opportunity to win this drawing, please go to themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode. And in the blog towards the bottom, there is a registration form that you can sign up and perhaps be a lucky winner. If you reside in the U.S., postage is free. If you are outside the U.S., then Eric can calculate how much the foreign postage is going to be and notify you. And if you're willing to pay for that foreign postage, then he will send that to you. If you decide not to pay that, then we'll go and draw a second name. So anyhow, go and check that out. And even if you are not a winner, let me say that if you buy a book through themagicbookshop.com, that you're still a winner because all of your purchases are 15% off. Yes, that's right. It gives a 15% discount to listeners of Magic Words. So just be sure in the promo code as you're exiting after you have purchased something that just be sure to put in the promo code when you check out Magic Word, all one word, no spaces, no dashes, anything like that, and you'll get your 15% discount. In addition to that, he even gives you a free book. Whenever you buy a magic book, that he'll throw in another book for free. And let me say again, just a big shout out to what Eric is doing. He recognizes that during this time that we're all under economic duress. So we're not necessarily trying to sell you things during this difficult time when you're having enough difficulties trying to generate your own income and to pay for necessities, whether it's going to be rent or groceries and whatever else. But if you're interested in a book that he has, contact him. If you are financially short, if you're kind of at a crossroads right now and really trying to decide, do I add another book to my collection? Do I need this that badly? He might be able to help out with the purchase price of that. So again, if there's something on themagicbookshop.com that interests you and but you don't think that you could afford, you might write him and see if there is something he can do to work out some sort of a payment plan or some way of helping out. So thank you, Eric, and go check it out. Well, I want to jump into this fairly quickly here because it got to be a little bit longer episode than what I had originally planned. We continued talking, and in fact, that towards the end, Dan and I felt like that we were not finished talking. There was so much else we could discuss. But I know that you're going to enjoy my discussion with inventor, creator, builder, hypnotist, marketer, ventriloquist, Daniel Summers, this week on The Magic Word.
So
So today we are with my good friend, Daniel Summers, and for a little bit of context and background, there have been a few articles have been published about him in Vanish Magazine and in Magic Magazine. He is perhaps best known today as being a creator and builder of magic illusions, but he started out then as a ventriloquist and then has moved from ventriloquism into magic, and then with magic started doing a lot of cruise ships and then working in Japan and other places with big review shows and working in Las Vegas and having lived in L.A. and other places just around the country, and then started working a college circuit with a hypnosis act. And so then kind of settling where he is now here in Houston and working with building illusions, coming up with different ideas. And so we're in his home right now enjoying a few martinis. And so hello, Dan.
Well, hello, Scott. And wow, you know, you've certainly done your homework. And I think you've covered just about everything. And so this is probably going to be the shortest
interview
you've ever had. And good night. And I think we'll finish these martinis and call it a night.
They are not too bad.
Do a good job. It's almost as if you have had experience in this. Have you ever made them before?
Not my first rodeo, even though the rodeo is going on in Houston right now.
You carry your own glass with you? Maybe I'm telling you a little secret.
Yeah.
And your own shaker. And you can move in.
Have glass, we'll travel. That's right. A martini. Well, listen, there are so many different things that I kind of want to cover, and some things that have kind of come and gone, that is phone rooms. I know that you had done some phone room business and were very big in that. And also early on in cruise ships, I think what's interesting is I was reading one of the articles. It said that the cruise line had actually contacted you about doing cruises, because typically it's the other way around. Magicians are looking to find these venues and they're trying to get onto cruise ships.
But I was really fortunate. I was just quite blessed. But it actually it was because of an act that I had met earlier on, an act, Bill Boley, a ventriloquist, mm-hmm. who I worked with at Cane Tuck Territory in Paducah, an 1880s theme park.
Cane Tuck.
Cane Tuck Territory. Oh, my gosh.
You must have some stories about that, because I remember hearing that Lance Burton and Matt King, I think, had worked some sort of...
Yeah, they were just down the road.
Did you know them?
It wasn't... I didn't know them at the time, I think... If I remember correctly, I think their park was called Guntown Mountain or something like that. But it was a different 1880s theme park. Mm-hmm. But they were, you know, both in Kentucky. And that was my first professional gig out of high school right away. Hmm.
In college or not? Or
no. You know, my dad would always say, you know, we were lucky to get you out of high school.
Okay.
Okay. I got out of high school. I didn't stick around for the ceremony for graduation. I was so excited to go and work at this amusement park, Cane Tuck Territory. I actually left 2 weeks early. One of the other entertainers that were performing at Cane Tuck, Bill Boley, ventriloquist, like I said, he would work there in the summertime and then work at Cane Tuck or Carnival Cruise Lines the rest of the year. And he was actually the one that recommended me to Carnival. And they had called me a couple times asking me to come on board. I didn't have to search out that gig. It just came to me. It just kind of fell in my lap. The entertainment director back then, his name was Arthur Ashton. We're still friends. Asked me to come on board, and the ship was in dry dock. It was the Christmas season, mm-hmm. and the magician that they had wanted to be home with the family during the Christmas season.
What was the line?
It was Carnival. Mm. Carnival back then was in their infancy. They only had three ships when I joined the company. They had the Carnival, the Mardi Gras, and the Festival. And like I said, they were in their infancy. And back then, not only were you one of the entertainers on board, but they asked the entertainers back then to do and participate in the other microphone activities.
Right.
And like
calling bingo,
and doing horse racing, anything that had to do with a microphone activity out on deck, doing fun and games in the sun, pillow fights, and beer mm-hmm. drinking contests, and all of that.
And you said you had something that was like a male, what am I trying to say, nightgown contest?
Oh,
something?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. The male nightgown competition and the knobby knees competition, the passenger talent show.
All kinds of fun things.
And you know, the funny thing is a lot of the older entertainers, you know, they kind of didn't like that aspect of the job.
Let me talk about that just a second, because mm-hmm. Ricky Dunn told me, you know, before I worked my first cruise ship, when you start working on cruises, you need to demand to have passenger status. So this way that you're not going to be calling bingo and doing all these mm-hmm. kinds of things, helping with shuffleboard,
right.
Because you need to be recognized as the professional you are. And that if they see you doing all these other kinds of things, you know, it's like they feel like, well, you can just, why don't you order something through you? You know, like you're the waiter for them or something.
You know what?
But that was the way Ricky was. And so.
Yeah, yeah. And that, and you're absolutely right. That was the mindset of a lot of the professional, the older professional yeah. entertainers. But keep in mind, when I joined them, I was 19 years old.
Mm.
And
Ray, do anything.
And I was game to do anything.
Sure.
It gave you something to do. You got to meet a lot of different people mm. and socialize with a lot of people and make new friends.
Right.
It gave you something to do during the day. I mean, if you're just an act, you know, you're only working, you know, three or four nights or three or four shows a week, and that was pretty much it. But when you doubled as an act and as a crew staff, it gave you something to do. You know, mm-hmm. to me, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
They couldn't give me enough stuff mm-hmm. to do.
How long did that love last?
I would do it again today.
Would you? Okay.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
I just wondered if after some point that it kind of got to, because I had read again that you had said that like after a while you kind of realized this was 7 days with no let up whatsoever.
Well, that's the job in its entirety.
Yeah.
You know, because you're doing the same thing, you know, with your act is, you know, it's the same act.
Right.
Same activities. And it was like
just different people, different port, different crap they're selling on the beach.
Yeah, and there comes a time, you know, after a decade, you know, of doing that. You know, it's like that movie, Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
You know, you do the same thing. And so, of course, once you do it a certain period of time, then your mind starts thinking, well, I wonder what else there is to do. You know, maybe I can go on land and just do my show.
And yet at some point you were actually offered an opportunity to be a cruise director at the same time you had another opportunity.
Yeah. And I was assistant cruise director. And whenever the cruise director would become ill or had to leave the ship for whatever reason, I would take on the cruise director responsibility. And back then, being a cruise director was a little bit different than it is today. We were responsible for example, the embarkation talk, the shop talks, mm-hmm, the shore excursion talks, the debarkation talks, emceeing all the shows.
Wow.
And so, so there was really a lot involved, you know, the job description for a cruise director. But I relished it. I loved it. And
well, you're a people person. And you have to be, I think.
Well, you really, yeah. Yeah, you have to be. Yeah.
Did you ever get any negative cards?
I mean,
it sounds like you're a positive person and would get some really good ones, but everybody's got to have
something.
Well,
I'll tell you, there's sometimes, I worked with some cruise directors that absolutely hate, did not want to engage with passengers.
Wow.
And I always wondered in the back of my head, how did you get into this
job,
position?
Exactly.
How did you get this job? My training before I even got into the cruise industry, I worked at a resort outside of Chicago. It was between Chicago and Milwaukee. It was called Nipissing Manor. And it was a we had guests that would
sink
come,
or swim manner,
nip or sink, yeah, nip or sink manner, sink or swim. Yeah. You know, oh gosh, people like wonderful acts like Jeff Hobson was one of the acts that he got his start there at nip or sink manner. But we would do we would have orientation before the resort would open up, and some of the training has stayed with me, and I even train people with some of the things that I learned. Just for an example, in the resort industry, and this helped me on cruise ships, we were taught that when you pass a guest in the hallway, you just don't walk by and say hello, good morning, good afternoon, or whatever. You always stopped in your track and you engaged with that person, with that guest.
Really?
You stopped and you engaged, and you find out, you know, what are your plans for the morning? Do you know what the activities are for the afternoon? You know, where are you from? First cruise, whatever.
Really?
But no. That was my training before I even joined, you know, the cruise line.
Because you did that at Cane Tuck, probably, with the people there, even?
And, yeah.
In a way.
And Cane Tuck was, you know, that was just a great starting point. And that was, like I said, right out of high school. I was so excited to have that job. It was my first professional job out of school. And I went to I went to the resort 2 weeks ahead of time. You know, I set up. They gave me the Bella Union Palace, which was an air-conditioned theater.
That's always nice.
Yeah, because some of the acts who had been there longer, they were working outside. Yeah, they were on the outside stage, yeah. And but they gave me the air-conditioned theater, Bella Union Palace, and I arrived at the at that amusement park 2 weeks ahead of time, and of course I'm set up. I'm ready to go. What to do? I would go over to the one of the outdoor theaters where they had a musical show, a dance and singing, you know, musical show called Our Southern Heritage Show, and I would go up and sit in the light booth and just watch their rehearsals. You know, this is before the resort or the amusement park opened.
The season
up.
Opened, yeah.
And you know what? If you're hanging around and you don't have anything to do, and someone sees that, you know, they will find you something to do. You know, and the producer of the dance show said, you know, Dan, would you mind running the foul spot? You know, would you mind, you know, doing the audio for us while, you know, during the rehearsals? Of course, you know, I would do anything.
So a lot of time you learned all these other.
Yeah,
and
I'm watching, and I'm working the spotlight. I'm doing the sound, and loving it. Three or four days before the park opened up, for whatever reason, they had to let one of the cast members leave.
Okay.
You know, they let them go, and so there was a part open. You know, and they were looking for people to audition, and the producer looks up. Is it Dan? You know, you want to come down and give this a try, you know, and I already knew, you know, I knew the music, the lyrics,
sure.
I you know, and the choreography was, to me, was pretty simple. And so I went down and I did a quick audition, and he said, well, you know what? You got the job.
Just like that.
And so my first season at Cane Tuck, you know, I would do the music and dance show. And there was three of them a day. But after the dance show, then I would get in my street clothes and run across the park and change for, you know, my magic show, you know, and I do the magic show and then change back into my street clothes, run back over to the Southern Heritage Theater and, you know, do that show again. So doing six shows a day there. And yeah, it was just a joy. You know, it was fun. It was a great experience.
And gave you a lot of experience, and you learned a lot that you could take on then later, like you said, then with the cruise ships and then whatnot. But then, as I was kind of alluding to as well, that whenever you had the opportunity to actually be a cruise director versus doing something else, you had this other job that you decided to take instead.
Yeah, I kind of knew that the company was grooming me for, you know, to take over. They were buying another ship. And Let me backtrack. One of my responsibilities was working the shore excursion office, and that was selling tickets to the shore excursions mm-hmm. and the evening shows. And so I got to know all the producers and the people who were running the shows at the various hotels there in Puerto Rico.
Okay, so they were on shore. They weren't the shows actually on the ship. So after they got off, you were selling tickets to the casinos or hotels and wherever they had other kinds of...
Yeah, the show... the cruise line would advertise for shows off ship.
Oh.
When the... say, for example, when the ship was in dock in mm-hmm. Puerto Rico, we would take groups of passengers to the, say, for example, Condado Plaza Hotel for a Las Vegas-style show.
Hmm, okay.
And so we were responsible for...
Selling tickets to that show.
To that show. And all the producers every day that we were in dock would come to our office and say, well, how many tickets have you sold? You know, and they, you need to get the numbers up, and yeah. And so, we would form a relationship, with those producers. And one in particular said, came to me one day and said, Dan, we're losing the magician in our show. Would you consider, coming in and working in our show? It was, the show was called Latin Fever, and it was at the Condado Plaza at the Holiday Inn in Puerto Rico. And there, I was weighing it. What do I do? I can work two shows every night in beautiful, sunny San Juan, Puerto Rico, or I could work week after week as a cruise director.
They're both dream jobs.
Both dream jobs, but my passion, of course, was magic.
And just performing.
And so I opted for, going to join Latin Fever. And so I quit.
Was that really more of a review show where the magic was part?
Okay. Yeah, it was a review show.
Dancing and singing.
And you only did mostly
minutes.
Dancing. And there was maybe two other variety acts, a pickpocket and a comedian was in that show. But doing two shows a night in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. you have your days free. That was just a dream job as well. And I met some wonderful people there on the island. Goldfinger and Dove were working at the hotel next to me.
Mm-hmm.
They were at the... Caribe Hilton Hotel, and Jack Dove and I became really good friends. I was probably a pest back then, being 19. When I would get off the ships, I would make two phone calls. First, I would call my mom and dad.
Yeah,
and then the next call was to Goldfinger Dove, where they were staying there on the island. Hey Jack, you want to get together for lunch? and then, like I say, I was probably the biggest pain in the ass he ever had. But we became really, really good friends, and he had a bunch of patience for me, and he kind of took me under his wing and taught me a lot of things about magic, we would have lessons with card manipulation and the dancing cane and the torn restored newspaper. Well, essentially his act.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when you're working that, I was just thinking as far as an opportunity, I would think as a cruise director, that could turn into a lifetime profession.
Yeah.
If you're working in a review show, that's going to be a year or two, perhaps.
Well, exactly. But you know what? When you're a kid, you don't think of things like that.
You don't think that far ahead.
Nah, you don't.
Okay.
My passion was I just wanted to do my show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was
and it was
passion.
Illusions also.
And it was Illusions.
Okay,
yeah.
Even way back then.
My bread and butter was my Dove act.
Okay.
But I also, I always incorporated Illusions.
What was your biggest box trick?
Furniture trick.
you hate hearing that term?
Well, no, because it's the truth. I mean, that's just reality. when I was in high school and aware of Doug Henning at the time, do you remember the collage of Illusions that was on the back of the Time magazine article with Doug Henning.
No.
And it was a beautiful four-color spread of all of the illusions Doug Henning had in the magic show on Broadway.
Wow.
And I had to have every single one of them. In high school, I began building each one of those illusions.
In shop?
In my basement at home in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin.
But you'd taken shop, apparently, in high school to learn how to do this.
I did. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I built the thin model sawing. One of the first ones, of course, was the zigzag. And I had a copy of the Harbin book. And that was the illusion of the time. And that was the origami box at the time.
Zigzag.
That was the zigzag. You know, everybody had to have one. And so with the Harbin book, you had the, you know, you saw the original design and dimensions for everything. And so that was my first illusion that I built. And I went on, built the Miss Maid and the Crystal Casket and the thin model sawing. Like I said, I had to have everything.
That's a lot of stuff to kind of haul onto the cruise ships and to tour around with.
Well, when I first joined the ships, I had the zigzag. That was my a staple, and I had a broom suspension.
Did you build it according to the plan so it would fold flat?
Oh my gosh, did I? Yeah. but when I built it, the sides, I built the sides out of eighth inch masonite, and the hinges were pop riveted. It folded flat.
Okay.
It essentially went into a suitcase.
Holy cow. A zigzag in a suitcase.
A zigzag in a suitcase, yeah. I mean, just imagine. The sides were eighth inch. The front and the back were 3/8 inch. And the inside, I had felted the inside. But
also has to be built for the size of your assistant. I remember when I had my first zigzag, well, I've only had one zigzag, and I told them the size of my wife, the height. Because most people just buy, you know, just a zigzag, and then they try to force someone into it.
Sure.
And in that case, you probably learned a lesson back then, too, about the height of your assistant fitting in the zigzag.
Well, I would always find someone that would fit.
Okay.
That would fit. I followed the real dimensions of the zigzag. But, you know, you're right. And the prop isn't for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every body is a different shape.
Yep.
And, you know, certain parts of the body, it can get in the way. And
you're pointing to your breasts. Give me a visual here.
And sometimes I have to lift them up and put them on top of the, but,
I can see that show.
Yeah. We need an interior.
Did you ever have a
camera
show and something happened as far as like a costume malfunction?
No, not okay. A costume malfunction. I mean, but there's always something that happens. But where were we?
We
backtracked.
Three different subjects. That's right. So you were talking about, you know, you were building the illusions, and we were.
You
know, then you were also. So was that Puerto Rico, where that you were performing then, and with Jack and everything then too? How many years did that last?
Yeah, the review was a year, I think a year. But I was going to Puerto Rico for several years, you know, with the ships, with the cruise lines.
Okay,
you know, I was so I was on.
After that year ended, did you go back to the ships?
When that ended, I moved out to Los Angeles. I moved out to Valencia, just north of LA.
Mm-hmm.
Up by Magic Mountain.
Why? Oh, did you work at Magic Mountain? Or?
No. My partner at the time lived there.
Okay.
And so I moved out to California, and I did a...
Not because the Magic Castle is just other magicians out there? That just...
No, just because that was my first relationship, my first partner, and that's where he lived.
You just happened to live there?
To live there, and I thought, well, California, kind of cool. Let's try this. And I moved out there, designed a brochure, and at that time there was I forget the name of the source material, but there was a book that you could buy that had all of the agents in LA, and it indicated if they hired variety acts, you know, what kind of venues that they put acts in,
and so, you're not talking about acting agents for movies.
No, variety acts.
Variety acts.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and so I designed a brochure, and I did a mass mailing to all of the agents that I could find that handled variety acts in LA, And I got a call from just a couple weeks. I got a call right away from an agent by the name of Ross Christina. He was Jane Mansfield's agent.
Agent? Wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he called me into his office and he said, Dan, I have an opportunity for you in Japan. And he said, if you would like this job, the only thing that you have to do is bleach your hair. I okay. guess because all guy jeans are all foreigners, you know, they have blonde hair. And, you know, I said, well, I'm on my way. I'll make my appointment. You know, I want this job.
Well, now, you were born in Japan. Is that right?
I was born in Japan. Yeah. My dad was in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And I was born in Fukuoka, Kyushu Island, in Irezuki.
Did you ever learn to speak any Japanese?
Well, I did not then.
Okay, it wasn't until this later that we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We left Japan when I was three.
Oh, well, there you go.
And we moved to Italy and Germany. We lived out of a suitcase for a while. Yeah, it wasn't until later that I learned Japanese.
So you went back to Japan and you started doing the shows there.
I went to Japan. And these were 6-month contracts, 6 months on, 6 months off, 6 months on.
At a casino or where?
And they,
resort?
The first few were traditional Japanese resorts. And they have a custom there where large corporations treat all of their employees to a night out. And so they bus entire companies into the hotel,
okay,
and they give them a wonderful dinner and a dinner show. They get to use the hot springs, you know, the hot baths, and then they bring them up to the main stage, main nightclub room, to see the, you know, the American show is it was. And so, like I said, it was like 6 months on, 6 months off. And I absolutely fell in love with Japan.
Did you think about moving and living there?
I would do it in a heartbeat.
Even today?
Even today. Yeah, I would do it in a heartbeat. I made so many wonderful friends.
Now, what about your partner back in L.A.? So was he? Did he come over with you then to Japan?
He came to visit a couple times.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But
he wasn't as wild about Japan as you were?
No. But I just fell in love with the country. I fell in love with the people.
The people, yeah.
You know, they just have a completely opposite look on life than Americans do. I realized that early on. It was what can I do for you? Mm-hmm. What can I do for you? Rather than what can I get from you?
I see. You know? Big difference.
Big difference.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something that happened early on, like the first week in the hotel. One of the illusions that I did was there was a space scene, and I was doing the neon light bulb suspension. And anyway, the prop did not get struck soon enough, and one of the flats came flying in and hit my prop. And broke the neon, both neon light bulbs. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about it until I came out of the dressing room, and I see all the stage lights are on, and I see the techs, the sound techs, and the light techs, and all the backstage techs just surrounding my prop, and they're all talking amongst themselves. I don't know what they're saying.
Right.
But they're talking amongst themselves, and let me tell you, not one of them went home until that prop was fixed.
Wow.
Yeah, they had
responsibility for it.
They removed the neon light bulbs, and they replaced them with regular. They took out the transformers, incandescent bulbs, which just made it more practical and safer, mm-hmm. and you know, easier to fix if one went out. But that was my first experience.
That wasn't an Owen Redwine thing, was it?
Pardon me.
Was that an Owen Redwine thing that he had built? Because I know he used neon and...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that was one that I built.
Okay, you know? Never mind.
Yeah. And yeah, I built it just for the show, for that particular show.
And so they fixed it and you were able to go back and...
Yeah, but my point was that they did not go home until, you know, it was late at
That's
night.
Great.
Until it was all fixed. Mm-hmm. And so they just have a wonderful work ethic. And yeah.
So you were on for 6 months, then off 6 months. And when you went off, I guess back to LA, or did you stay in?
Yeah, I would go off and I would go back on ships
for those 6 months,
you know, because Carnival, they would keep acts on 6 months on, you know, a month off, six mm-hmm. months on, you know, a couple months off. Once they had you on board, you know, they wanted to keep you on board.
Yeah.
If they're going to pay the expenses for your illusions and your transportation, they want to keep you. They want to keep you there, you know,
okay.
at the time. And and like I said earlier, Carnival was in their infancy, and to help you stay, they would put acts on a profit sharing.
Really?
Yeah. And so,
how'd that work out? And they, I don't understand how. What?
Beautifully.
Okay, which is why that you know there for
it
so
was
long.
Profit sharing on your, you know, on the onboard gambling, not the casino, but all the other onboard gambling activities that they had.
Oh, you mean like with a bingo and whatever
bingo
else?
Bingo, horse racing.
Okay, so that's
doubles.
One of the reasons you like to call it, because you were actually making some money off of whatever. Okay, now it's kind of coming.
I didn't say that.
Well.
I didn't say that. Now you're putting words in my mouth.
It's just a martini talk. okay, well, that's interesting. So your salary was a base of X dollars, but it was supplemented with the percentage of the...
Yeah.
And winnings.
You know, and in a way, it kind of spoiled the young person, because I was in my early 19, 20, 21, and you thought that it was that life was always going to be like this.
And how much were you making, if you can share, back then?
You know,
annually.
That's a dangerous question.
You don't have to answer. Just...
But it was very lucrative.
It was long.
You know, it was
okay.
Lucrative. You know, my father was working for the state of Wisconsin, and I would say it was probably four times his salary.
More than him, yeah.
You know, and I'm just a kid. And
you know,
you think it's always going to be like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get on land and you realize, you know, reality comes and hits you in the face. You know?
Yeah. After I had spoken with David Stone some time ago, and this was like 2012, one of my favorite podcasts. And when I was chatting with him, he was saying that whenever he was asked by an agent, if you'd be interested in earning more in 3 months than what your father does in a whole year, would you be interested? And he said, yes. And he took him down to the south of France and was working Monte Carlo and, you know, for all these high rollers. And he said, easily, yes, I did very well down there. Yeah. I can understand, you know, where that you start to see that you're getting in some money. It's like, I don't need to go back to school. I don't, you know, I'm
well, exactly.
I'm doing well, and,
you know, mm-hmm. exactly. I mean, college just was not an option for me. I thought, why?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a different world back then. And, before I left the cruise ships, I should share this story with you. Jack was such a wonderful friend to me, Jack Goldfinger. Like I said, I would bother him every time the ship would come into dock. But I'll tell you, he said something to me that really changed my world. We were working on card manip one afternoon, and he just happened to ask me. He said, "Hey, Dan, what is it that you want to do when you get off the ships? You know, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Where do you want your career to take you?"
Yeah.
And he said, "What's one thing that you want to do in your future?" And I had never been out to LA at that time. And I said, I would really like to perform on the Magic Castle stage. You know, that's every magician's, mm-hmm. you know, dream. And he says, oh, Jack, oh, okay.
Yeah.
He said, Dan, close your eyes. Okay, close
yeah.
my eyes. He said, just imagine yourself on the Magic Castle stage. Do you see it? I said, well, yeah, I do. He said, look at the audience. You see the audience? You see them enjoying your act? Yeah. He said, color in that picture. You know, just imagine that you're working on the Magic Castle stage. You're doing your act, and the audience is loving it. Isn't that great? I said, yeah, that's great. He said, okay, Dan, open your eyes. I opened my eyes. And he said, guess what? What? He said, it's already happened. What do you mean? He said, it has already happened. Dan, all you have to do now is let reality catch up to you and smell the roses along the way.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. You want to tell? Can I tell you something?
Hmm, yeah.
3 months later, I was booked at the castle.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, that was a bit of visualization.
Sure.
Creating something in your mind, you know, seeing something and creating it, you know, and it works today, whether it's creating an illusion, you know, you want to see a different visual, a new visual. Okay. You envision it, you imagine it. And then you just, it's kind of like a baby in embryo just waiting to be born.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just allow it to unfold.
I've heard that before about when you're playing golf, that, and I practice this as well, is that as I'm lining up to hit the shot, I envision where the ball will land, how far it's going to be going, and about where I want the ball to, you know, I may hook or slide, it may not end up that way, but, you know, my perfect shot would look like this, and you're imagining that. And so oftentimes, and I'll hit the ball, you know, fairly well enough to get kind of close to where my perfect shot would be. Similarly, whenever that I would go into a restaurant, let's say I'm working close up in a restaurant, and so before I walk in, the first thing I do is put on a smile. As I'm walking from my car to the front door, it's like, I love these people. I'm going to have a great time. They're going to enjoy this. And I'm smiling to myself. And I, even if I have had a bad day, I would smile. I will just paste a Joker grin on my face, basically, you know, and just walk in, and I'm there to have a great time, you know. And Thurston used to do that, you know, peek behind the curtain, say, I love you, you know, and to look at that. I think if you have a good positive attitude to begin with, that it will happen.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Yeah, I believe in that 100%. You know, it's all your mindset. You don't want to go into a situation, you know, worried and stressed out.
No.
You know, and thinking of all the negatives that may
and your audience
happen.
Will pick up on that also.
Ah, you know, sure, sure.
They can see if you are the same thing. Whenever that you're on the phone, if you smile, you know, the listeners, I would like you to try this. Whenever that the next time you're on the phone, put a smile on your face as you say hello and as you're talking to somebody. That will come across the phone.
Absolutely.
You know. Yeah. And so you'd work phone rooms, and so you kind of know about that. I want to talk about phone rooms also, by the way, then as well. But before that, that kind of was where the hypnosis came before the phone rooms, kind of. Is that right? In the college circuit? And why did you start doing hypnosis?
Well, my hypnosis interest actually came, yes, you're right, before the phone rooms. But I didn't develop an act with hypnosis until after my phone rooms. When I left high school, you know, I had a very good friend of mine. It got me an audition in Chicago. Of all of the agents, national agents throughout the country that booked school assembly programs, and
school meaning college or high school.
It was elementary school. Junior high, high school,
okay.
and colleges.
Okay.
It ran the gamut. And so all of the agents once a year would get together at a auditorium in Chicago, and they would hold auditions. And
like a NACA kind of a thing?
A NACA kind of a thing, yeah. But it was just – It was before NACA. And I wasn't out of school yet. I think I was a junior in high school, and I went and did the audition. And I was lucky enough, three of the agents offered me contracts. There was Dakota Assemblies out of Fargo, and there was a Chicago agent that handled the Midwest, and the National School Assemblies out of North Hollywood. They all gave me offered me contracts. And that was, you know, that was also a beginning. The amusement park after high school only lasted, of course, 3 months,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then it was the school season.
Right.
And I went to the first one was Dakota Assemblies. I worked for them for 8 months, a school season. And you would do 3 to 4 shows a day. you never got on a plane. You know, you would travel. You know, I had a little Pinto wagon.
Remember Pinto?
And I survived. Yeah. Never got rear-ended. Pinto wagon. And like I said, you 3 to 4 shows a day. And then I went to National School Assemblies the next 2 years out of North Hollywood. And so, yeah, you would do 400 schools every 8 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was before, you know, that was before Carnival Cruise Lines. But just a great,
that great couldn't
experience.
Have paid a lot back then either, but it kept you busy.
This was 1977, 78, 750 a week.
A week. Right. And how many shows a week?
$750 a week.
Yeah, but I mean, how many shows did you?
Oh, 12 to 16 a week.
For $750.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so cruise ships were a lot better than that.
But but I'll tell you, hotels were $12 a night.
Well, that's,
you know.
Yeah. That's why Motel 8 was called Motel 8.
You could have
Motel
breakfast
8.
And lunch for $3, you know. So, but for a kid, you know, 18 years old back then, you know, that was good money.
Oh, sure.
That was really good money.
Sure, sure. So in working the before we get into college circuits, I think we need to shake up another martini.
I think you're right.
Okay.
It'd be rude not to.
I'm going to pause this for just a moment. Okay. Let's take a break.
It's martini time.
All right. So we are back, and so we got these shaken up and start for our second portion of this. So you had, I think we were talking about the hypnosis acts and working phone room shows. Is that where we were, I believe? So the hypnosis, why'd you move from magic and mentalism, or mental magic, into doing a hypnosis show and working the college circuit?
Well, the hypnosis show actually came after our sponsored shows. You know, we did probably a decade of sponsored shows. When I left, the last time I left Japan, I went into doing Stan Kramian's sponsored shows.
Okay.
You know, actually, I worked for him for a little while.
Stan kind of was a millionaire, then bankrupt, and kind of went back and forth several times, didn't he?
Sponsored shows at that time were outstanding.
Yeah.
You know, if an act wanted to do their own illusion show, you know, every night and make a living at it, the sponsored shows were really the answer because you were, you know, your own boss. I worked for Stan for a while. And
he was the one who owned the phone room.
Yeah, he did. Back then, he was living in
Oregon, Washington.
Washington State. When I was doing the school assembly programs, every once in a while, I would see his posters, you know, his advertisement of Magicapades.
Magicapades, that's right, because Magic on Icecapades or on ice kind of a thing, right?
Right, right. And I probably made a nuisance of myself because when I was done for the day, I would drive over to wherever he was working and wherever he was putting his show up. And I would go and help them load in, load out, and watch the shows. And I could tell, that there was, there was some money to be made in the sponsored shows, show business.
Because he would pay you X dollars, regardless of how many people. Explain briefly for those people, particularly overseas, who may not understand what phone rooms are and or were, and also those perhaps here in the U.S. who don't remember that time, that era.
Essentially, with sponsored shows, you go into a community and you find your sponsor. Our sponsors would always be badge organizations. Mm-hmm. They were always the strongest. Police organizations, fire departments, volunteer fire departments. Occasionally, we would do civic organizations like the JCs or the Lions Club. Mm-hmm. But I would schedule a meeting at one of their meetings, and I would go in and give a presentation. And my presentation was a little bit different than Stan's. And I never had anyone turn me down with this pitch.
Wow.
And
what'd you say?
And the that'll cost you. But the contract that I would arrange with our sponsors was something like this. I would say to them, we will come into your community, and we will bring in this show, this a part of Americana, this illusion show, magic show. We will pay for all of the performers, all of the variety artists, all of the tech crew. We'll pay for their transportation. We'll pay for the show. And we will give you 100% of the gate.
Okay.
We'll give you 100% of the tickets that your organization will able to sell. Plus, we'll give you 20% of what our office sells for you.
Okay.
And so in reality, we only depended on what we did.
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
And because the truth be told,
there weren't a lot of walk-ins.
The club members really were not interested in selling tickets. Mm-hmm. You know, they have better, they have lives.
Sure.
You know, they don't really want to go out and solicit and sell tickets.
Mm-hmm. It's like selling Girl Scout cookies.
Yeah. and in fact, by the time the show played, the auditorium was sold out already. I would go into a town, and we would set up a temporary office and have a bank of phones, and I would hire local people to do the telemarketing. Okay. I would train the telemarketers. I'd have 5 satellite offices running at any one time. But we would have 2 shifts, one shift that would work the days, operators that would contact the businesses, offering them books of tickets to pass out to their preferred customers and friends. And then we would have a change of shift. Another shift would come in at 5 o'clock and contact residents from 5 to 9 in the evenings, and they would sell family passes to the show. You know, it was like it would admit 5 people of their choice to the show for $25. And so that's how we were able to sell the tickets. We did it on location for probably 5 years. But when John and I moved to Houston, we opened up a central office where we wouldn't have to travel so much. Long distance charges were down to pennies. And we spent about $100,000 on a predictive dialer system. And we would have as many as 16 operators doing 2 shifts, you know, again, working businesses during the days, blocks of tickets, and then residential tickets in the evenings. Mm-hmm. And we had our office here in Houston for, a good 10 years,
wow,
I would say. And that was before the Attorney General's office intervened with the
do not call
list. That was a big problem. And of course, cell phones, you know, became in vogue. And so it was really time. That was, you know, the wake up call that we really had to restructure,
right,
you know, the business. And I just went ahead and sold the whole show, sold our tap cards, candy cards, and our towns contracts. But there were towns that we would go to, you know, 10, no, well, there was a few that we had worked 15 years in a row.
I've worked those kinds of shows. I remember doing something up in Amarillo, Texas, and a guy named Varga had put this thing together. And it was a big theater, but there probably weren't more than 60 people in the whole theater.
Isn't that a shame? That's a shame.
Yeah.
We never wanted that to happen, and it's so easy to happen. Because people really, you know, they purchase the tickets because they want to help out the organization.
Yeah.
That's primarily why they purchase the tickets. It's not exactly to come see you.
Yeah. No, actually, you're just a generic magician. That's right.
But the wonderful thing about what we would do, we would make certain that we gave away more tickets than were bought to underprivileged kids. Like we would give tickets out to big brothers and big sisters, to, you know, the Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, nursing homes, retirement centers. We made sure that people were bussed in, and we made sure there was an audience.
Wow.
And not only because you want to work for an audience,
of course,
you know, you don't want to you don't want to set this entire show up with all these illusions and not work for anyone.
Yeah, that was back in the days when I was doing a Zigzag and the Dove Act, and you know, I had a rabbit and all that kind of stuff. You know, yeah, we did the big show.
Yeah.
Plus, there were other.
Yeah.
Things
yeah.
on there,
wasn't and you just want you want an audience.
Yeah, want an audience,
and most of those promoters and will not they don't care if there's an audience or not
because they're guaranteed of X dollars.
Right, but because it was our show, I made certain that we had a full crowd, a full auditorium.
Right,
and not only that, you know, one of my business partners, Paul Niebauer. Was in charge of the concessions, and when you walked into the lobby area, it was like it was like a toy store. You know, he had so many flashing lights, and we had cotton candy, we had popcorn, and we had we would go to every Disney show that was on the road to see what the hottest toy was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we would we would buy our stock from China. You know, and put our stickers on it, and we'd have, you know, our own light up swords and our own fiber optic toys. And
right.
And so, yeah, virtually a complete toy store, you know, in the lobby area. And that was just a plus.
Wow.
For sure.
And so after that, then you were doing the college circuit, or the college circuit was before that.
The college circuit actually came right after that when we found out that the no call list was coming.
It was drying up.
And cell phones were popular. I got out of that business and sold the Illusion Show and went to do hypnosis. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky. One of my very, very best friends in Chicago, he was a hypnotist for one of the premier college agencies. When I told him, you know, Frederick Winters is his name, and I said, I'm thinking about, you know, changing paths, and I would love to do my, you know, a hypnosis show in the college market. And so he invited me on board and helped me get in with the agency in Chicago. And so that was 20 years ago. And so I've been, you know, entrenched in the college market for 20 years. And it's a great market to be in. The kids are outstanding.
It still is. I remember talking with Denny Haney many years ago, and he was saying he got out of the college circuit because he thought it was done. And so that's why he opened a magic shop. And he later realized, no, the magic shops, brick and mortar, are the mm-hmm. things that are dying. It's the college market that's continuing to grow. He just kind of made a bad decision, I guess, at that time, because it is still pretty thriving.
Oh, it is. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. A lot of, a lot of acts are getting their start, you know, doing the college market.
Sure.
And I just, I love it. I love it. The students, they're just the right age. They have incredible creativity.
Mm-hmm.
They're uninhibited. And the shows just are great.
So much fun.
Yeah, so much fun.
I've seen you perform. You were, I think, at Rice University or someplace. I remember coming in.
I remember you coming. Yeah. And really, that was, well, that had to be, what, 20 years ago?
Yeah, probably Walter, Blaney, and I, and... Banachek, I think a few of us came over to watch
Banachek
the show.
Yeah, Banachek was there, I remember. Yeah. Banachek, yeah, you guys were right there up in front. Yeah. Rice University, yeah. And it's a great market. It really is a great market.
Well, I mentioned Walter Blaney because that you are now his, if you will, heir to the person who's going to be making his ladder levitation, and I guess you make his shadow box, sword box, and other kinds of his ideas, right?
You send me a check, I'll make it.
Pretty much anything, huh?
I can be bought. No, okay. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yes, you are. Because that I know you're very ethical, and that's just another thing having to do with there are so many people who are ripping off other illusions that have been developed by Jim Steinmeier and others.
Oh,
you know,
yeah. You know, he is poor Jim. Well, poor Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's doing okay.
Yeah. it's really a shame. But you're absolutely right. I think he's taken probably the brunt of it, because in our lifetime, in the last couple decades, you know, Jim has contributed probably the most, and has inspired more people to do illusions. Mm-hmm. And he keeps bringing new material to the table, you know, year after year after year. I really admire what he does. You know, and it's one thing to develop a unique visual and a different methodology, which he excels at. But what I really like about Jim is that he gives reason to rhyme. I call him the Wizard of Words. You know, he can take the most minimum amount of words and paint a beautiful picture, you know, on stage. He can tell a great story and give a reason for the visual, you know. Okay. I don't know anyone else who does that. Mm-hmm. You know, Jim is really at the top of his game. I mean, he's the beacon, you know, in the storm. He's the top dog, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And your building that you do, obviously that you've got permission to use their blueprints of whatever. And so I think what is unique that I had read about how that you receive payment is that it's not just for X dollars up front, but also a royalty for performance rights.
Right. I don't know anyone else. That's I'm impressed that you that you know that. Not very many people understand it. My take on the royalty issue is quite different than anybody else. I see it as not a royalty, but as a performance rights contract. Mm-hmm. I believe that any performer that is taking your material on stage and presenting it, I believe that they deserve that they're obligated to give the originator a royalty. Mm-hmm. Much like a Broadway play. Just, let's take that for example.
Like Cats.
Okay.
If the high school could be paying.
Yeah, let's say the local community theater is doing a version of Cats. They contact the clearinghouse in New York, and they receive a contract for a certain period of time to produce a certain number of performances for, say, Cats, whatever it is, and that's it. When the contract is over, when the engagement is over, when they've done their weekend of shows or whatever, the contract ends. Mm-hmm. That theater, that community theater, or whoever it might be, they don't have the ability to take those scripts and turn it over to another theater. They can't do that. You know, the other theater has to pay the rights. And so that's always been my perspective when it comes to original illusions, is that the performing rights should not travel with the prop. It should only go from performer to performer. Mm-hmm. That's just my take. And I know that there are people that don't agree with that. That's okay. They don't have to use my illusions.
Right.
You know, but that's just my take.
But if somebody sells one of your illusions, then the contract goes with that illusion, so that they are responsible for paying you that right.
Right.
That
when someone sells one of my illusions, the agreement is, and we've agreed beforehand, that to transfer the performing rights, the person buying the illusion must pay the performing rights.
Per show or under a variety of different kinds of...
The buyer purchases the performing rights. Yeah.
That's an interesting perspective of that. Kind of going a little bit along that line as far as ripping off people and piracy. Some years ago that Walter Blaney had formed the World Alliance of Magicians, WAM, which I was vice president, and you were involved with this as well way back when.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that the idea was to try to protect the rights of the creator, basically, to make sure that no one else was actually ripping off their ideas.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts about what you can do? I mean, there are, I know, like with the books that Banachek and I have put out, Psychological Subtleties and other kinds of things, and for that matter, DVDs and everything, you know, it seems to be ripped off or that are on torrents or something that you can find wherever. Mm-hmm. And I've talked with Max Maven about that, and he said, not much you can do about it, you know, and that's pretty true. Have you kind of come to that conclusion? It's kind of like you shrug your shoulders and say, well, it is what it is.
Yeah.
We opened a can of worms here.
Pardon me?
Am I opening up a can of worms here?
Well, No. I've seen the difficulty and the stress and the anxiety that it puts on creators, and especially Walter. You know, I watched him for years and years fighting that battle.
Right.
And you know, there's a couple of schools of thought. There were some magicians, professional magicians, who thought, you know, don't rattle the cage, don't make noise, don't give them publicity, don't let other people know that these knockoffs are available, yada yada. And I saw how it can really harm someone's happiness. You know, like my good friend Walter. You know, he has.
And he only lives, what, 4 miles from here?
Yeah, he's like just down the road. He's like my dad.
Mine too.
Yes.
Very close.
Yes. And it's really a shame to see someone, you know, obsessed about the ripoff. But it's a reality right now. And right now we have, you know, China Magic ripping off everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what. When you look at the pictures of the products that they produce, they're horrendous.
Yeah, the quality is horrible.
The quality, they might make it look on the exterior something similar, not quite, but similar to what you're advertising. But the mechanics inside, they have no idea what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They don't know how it really works. I've heard horror stories of people who have purchased, say, for example, Walter's Ladder Levitation, people who have purchased it from China Magic. They get it and it fails and
people
it breaks
fall.
And people fall and
injure themselves too.
And so it's a danger. It's a detriment.
So, you know, when I was in Cuba for Magic Cuba last year, that I was speaking with the Cubans magicians who were saying that they didn't know how this stuff worked. And I can understand in certain countries because of income that it is cheap. And I remember Walter telling me that he had someone write him one year that said something about, what was that? It was like from Africa. He said, you know, our annual income is less than what costs, you know, paying for an illusion would be. So if I was to make this or buy this cheaper, you know, I think that it's reasonable. Well, no, not really. I mean, I understand your plight and your country and the culture, but it's kind of difficult. And similarly, like in Cuba, it's like these guys will watch these videos on YouTube over and over and over and then recreate this as they believe that it can be made.
Sure.
And because of their inability, there is no Home Depot. They can go down and, you know, buy wood. They kind of have some wood that floats up on the island, apparently, you know, from time to time. So they'll have like some plywood or something, and they'll put this thing together or make it out of cardboard. I mean, I remember when I was down there, it was like they were fantastic. They were amazing magicians. Dance and everything else they put into it, and the illusions look great from stage. But when the girls would get into the things, they would kind of wobble like it was made out of cardboard or quarter-inch plywood or something. You know, it's like, yeah, that's got to be like a one-time use illusion or something, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So I can understand a little bit about how what you're talking about how people can rip that off or look at that and justify it as like, I can't afford it. Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a conundrum.
It is.
And my take on it is I'm always looking for, I mean, I had to teach myself this because in the early days, you know, I would get extremely upset when I would see a ripoff. Nothing can ruin your day more than receiving an email from a friend saying, well, have a look at this with a link. and you click on the link and it's someone who has ripped off your idea and they do it horribly,
yeah,
and it's badly built. It just ruins your whole day. You know, and I tell my friends, you know, you don't need to send this to me. Thank you. You know, and my take is on it. It's going to happen. The people that I want to do business with are the upper echelon, the top 5 or 10% of professional magicians who have ethics, and they want to do the right thing, and they want the prop to be built as, you know, it was originally designed. Mm-hmm. And those are my customers. Those are the people that I choose to work with. And there are always going to be the people who can't afford it and who are going to build it in their garage.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lose sleep over that. You know, life is too short. I don't want to worry about that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to become obsessed about that. And I don't want to fight that issue. My preference is, what's the next thing?
Hmm.
You know, that to me is more important.
I like that. What's the next thing?
I think Chris McBride. I was visiting his home one time, and he said, "Dan, what's your favorite illusion of all time?" And I said, "The next one."
Hmm.
You know, it's that next one. It's that next one that's going to come out of the shop.
Right.
You know, the one that hasn't been built yet.
That's a fun thing for you.
Oh, that's my
challenge.
That's my passion.
Yeah.
Is, I go into the shop, and I can build dozens. I build things 6-12 at a time. But that's not what I love to do. What I love to do is go in and build something that has never, whether it's my idea or someone else's idea, building something that has never seen the light of day,
mm-hmm,
doing the research and development of something that is just, it's a brand new visual, a brand new methodology. Because you go in the shop and time stands still. You know, when you're in that mode and you're thinking, okay, how is this going to go together? How is this going to work? Time stands still, you know, and for me, you know, that's my passion with magic, not cutting out jigs and doing something that's already been built 100 times before.
Right. As we start to close, there are a couple of things I
we have to close? Well, it's early.
I know it is early.
It's early. We've only just begun.
We have scratched the surface. There are so many facets of this diamond that's called Daniel Summers. That's true. One thing.
Are you falling asleep?
No, I'm not. No, although the martinis are pretty good.
And they're wonderful. You do a great job. You know,
Thank you.
I'm going to have to put you on payroll.
And that is Joni Spina, that was such a good friend of ours, and she lived here with you for a while in her final years. What are you pointing at there?
You got a
picture?
She's on the mantle.
Yeah.
And she's joining us.
You have her ashes up there, or what? She had stayed with you for the last remaining time of her life, and when she was down here in Houston looking for a lung transplant, and she was just the most, as if anyone had met Joni Spina, they know what a lovely, caring woman that she was. I remember when you had called me, and that was the last time I was over here at your house. You called and said, "Hey, Joni's got something for you. You know, she's in, you know, here in town." And I had just happened to mention, Kathy and I had just taken her back to the airport. And as we were traveling, we were talking about posters and talking about, you know, she said, "Well, I got some David Copperfield posters. I bet you don't have." And she was kind of getting rid of some things in her house, obviously, at the time. And so you called me and said, "Hey, she wants to talk to you, or she's got something for you. I came here." And she had rolls and rolls of these David Copperfield posters from the Orient and different places around the world of where that she had toured. And she said, "Here you go." And the fact that she has so much, she had so much else on her mind at the time, having to do with just staying alive and, you know, trying to get a lung transplant and being here with you and other kinds of things. But she was just a giving person. I can't say enough kind things about her. But the fact that you had opened your home and let her live here. I have a 3-story townhouse, so I really don't have there wasn't the ability, although I was closer to the hospital, it would have been ideal for her to stay with us. It was just not practical because of the oxygen that she needed and going up and down the steps to the and everything. But it was amazing what you had done for her at the time.
And Joni was just a diamond. She was an incredible individual, and it was an honor to have her here in my home. Mm-hmm. And she was just a gem. Such a wonderful, kind, loyal, generous, loving soul. Just a great person. And just like you said, she had a lot to worry about, as far as her health.
Her health, yeah.
But she constantly, when she was here, was trying to help other people. She would use my office and get on Skype, and she would do
lessons with people.
Lessons, mm-hmm. There was one young man, and she would Skype. She would watch his performance, mm-hmm. and then make notes during it, and then go through the notes.
Yeah.
And she was doing this while she was on oxygen.
Wow.
There was so many times when, I'd have to take her into emergency in the middle of the night, into ICU. She would be, I never met anyone that had more gratitude than Joni. And, the funny thing is sometimes we'd be in an emergency room and she was more concerned about the person who was behind the curtain next to her, than her own health.
Yeah.
It was just bittersweet. Like I say, it was a joy to have such an icon in our industry, be here at my house. It was a big responsibility.
It was
that, she trusted me as being a caregiver. And I took it, very seriously. But on one hand, it was great to get to know the real Joni, such a sweetheart, and I miss her dearly. So many people rallied around her. David Copperfield helped her out in a big, big way, mm-hmm. While she was here. He always stayed in contact with her was always looking out for her. And she had a lot of friends that would send her cards and, write her and stay in contact with her.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, before we close, one more thing. And I'm going to change the direction here and actually go full circle back to the beginning of your interest in ventriloquism.
Ah! Oh, geez.
You had told me briefly about a little story about somebody who had inspired you.
You're a very dangerous person. Yeah, you realize that.
Yes. So this was a fellow. I mean, you were inspired back when you were a child, and we were about 8 or 13, I think, at the time.
Oh, gosh.
Whenever that you called this guy out of
well,
the blue.
Well, we were, like I said, I was, being born in Japan, and we moved to Italy, Aviano, Italy, just, in northern Italy. My dad was in the Air Force. And at that time, of course, the NCO clubs would bring in, variety acts, to entertain the troops, the servicemen, and the kids. They probably thought, if you're going to do an adult show, we've got kids here, do a show for the kids.
Yeah.
And that was my first exposure to entertainment and to ventriloquism. And that was mm-hmm. my first interest was ventriloquism. And one of the acts that came on to the NCO base, NCO club was, I didn't know his name at the time, but I learned his name as later on as an adult. But was Lou DuPont
okay.
came and he He was a ventriloquist slash magician. He was a Las Vegas ventriloquist. And he had the adult show, and then he had the kiddie show. And he built his own figures. And, you know, they, I don't know how to, you can't say it delicately, but they were.
Adult?
They were very.
Anatomically correct?
Well, they were very ugly.
Oh, ugly, okay.
Figures. You know, not the cheeky boy, you know, good looking, okay. You know, ventriloquist yeah. figures that people like, you know, like Danny O'Day or whatever. But anyway, that was my first exposure to ventriloquism, and I loved, you know, I fell in love with ventriloquism, and he would work with three figures.
Okay.
He had this big buxom blonde figure. Mm-hmm. He had a normal, you know, funny looking figure. And then he had a little tiny guy that the one figure would operate.
You okay.
know? So it was really quite unusual. And that was my first exposure to ventriloquism. And I fell in love with ventriloquism then. But I realized, you know, a couple decades later that he was really doing a child's version of an adult show.
Okay.
Because he was on TV, HBO had a special with him on it, Lou DuPont, and like for example, the blonde, buxom blonde would say, "You want to see my chi-chis?" You know, and the little guy, you know, had a very low voice, and as a kid, I remember the little guy saying, "I'm hungry." But seeing his Vegas show later on in life,
yeah.
the guy, little dummy was saying, I'm horny, you know, and the buxom blonde, "You want to see my chi-chis?" And the little guy would say, "Yeah, show me your chi-chis," you know, and then all of a sudden the top of her dress would drop down. You know, and yeah. and she had these little, what do you call them, little pasties spinning around. here are my chi-chis. You know, these little pasties were spinning around. But that was my introduction to ventriloquism. You know, when I was a
and
kid.
You said this is for me.
And when we moved to Madison, Wisconsin, you know, when I was in elementary school. I was sixth grade. There was a local ventriloquist by the name of Howie Olson. Mm-hmm. His father was in vaudeville, Great Chesterfield. But I got the nerve to call him up on the phone. Looked him up on the phone in the phone book, and I called Howie Olson. I said, "Howie, Mr. Olson, do you teach ventriloquism?" And he said, "Absolutely." And he said that the lessons would be $3 an hour.
Wow.
And so every Saturday through junior high, my dad would take me over to Howie Olson's home, and I would get ventriloquist lessons. Mm-hmm. Now, Howie was a local celebrity. He had a show called Circus 3 on Channel 3 in Madison. And so Howie would write scripts, and we would rehearse the scripts, and he would have me on a show, and I would do like a minute of ventriloquism mm-hmm. on a show, and get to see it the next morning. It was That's a cartoon cool. show, yeah. You know, back then when you know Bozo
sure.
Circus,
sure.
you know, it was a cartoon show,
right?
And every market had
right
you know, such
right.
a show.
Yep, anyway, we did that, back yeah. in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So anyway,
all right. Well, listen. As we wrap up, then now my final question has to do with. My podcast, naming the Magic Word Podcast. And so I always like to ask my guests, what is your philosophy of life? What is your magic word? What do you, it's not just a word, it's a something you live by. You know, what's important to you? When you wake up in the morning, you know, what drives you?
Wow. That's deep.
Mm. Yeah. There are so many things I think that you would say, but I'm not going to put words in your mouth. So what's important?
Yeah. Wow. You know, I get my inspiration and my motivation from wanting to help other people,
okay.
other acts mm-hmm. in our business. That gives me the greatest pleasure,
you know, helping people
in life. It's in you know,
helping others.
What can I do for you?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, there's people out there that are just interested in the, you know, making a buck. But I think, you know, if there's something that I can contribute to an act, if there's anything in my background that can help, with someone that is just getting started, yeah, that's more important to me than anything else. You know, is what, you know, what can I do? What can I do for you?
Pay it forward.
You pay it forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got that only because everything positive that has ever happened in my world and in my realm has been people have, you know, given a hand up.
Hand up.
Hand up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, has helped me. You know, every job opportunity is
yes,
always...
You were talking about Jack Goldfinger telling you all these ideas and how to help.
Has always been from friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, just...
That's great.
You know, Bill Boley giving me the job on Carnival Cruise Line, helping me get that job on Carnival Cruise Line. Yeah, it's always been, in my life, has always been, you know, there's always been someone there saying, here, come with me. Help me. You know, you can help me. You can do this. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I can't tell you how great this has been. I've enjoyed having a chat with you.
No, I've enjoyed this. This has been great.
It's gone.
You know,
so
we've only touched the surface.
We really
you know,
have.
We must do chapter two.
I was thinking about making this a two-part thing, but yeah, there are so many things in directions I could have gone, certainly, and the stories and whatnot. So, Dan, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to see you. And you know, I don't know why I don't see you more. We live in the same city, you know, and it's unfortunate that we don't see each other more
exactly.
often. You know, I stay in my own little world up here. You know, I get up, do my thing, and I really don't get into town that often. The last time I saw you was probably at the Performing Arts Center with Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we need to do this more often.
We do. And it's just like we had
And you're a great mixologist. I've got to say, you are just the best, and you must leave your recipe with me.
I'll have to do that. All right. Well, until the next time, thank you very much. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate what you do for the art of magic and getting the word out and talking to people and teaching, you know, the young up-and-coming artists. You know, you really do a tremendous amount of wonderful work.
Thank you.
And keep it up.
That makes me feel good. And you know how to make people feel good. That is great. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was my good buddy, Daniel Summers. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Scotty out. I want to thank Dan Summers for being my guest this week, and I know that you guys got a lot out of this also. It was just an enjoyable chat, and I hope that you felt as if that you were sitting on the couch there alongside us and enjoying this and listening to our conversation then as well. Thank you again for tuning in each week, and thank you for patronizing our sponsor, themagicbookshop.com, and also thanks for subscribing to our pod letter. If you don't, then be sure and do that. So, as I mentioned, this was kind of a lengthy podcast, so I'll wrap it up. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and think about how that you can help others. And those are some important magic words right now in these very difficult times. This is Scotty out.